This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We take our civilization for granted, but it's fragile and pushing way beyond sustainable limits. How and why do civilizations collapse? In this program, we'll hear from specialists who study the end times of the Indus civilization of India and Pakistan and the Maya of Central America. Then we'll wrap up with a tough solution for our tough problems. A new book outlines how we could use World War II-style mobilization to save the climate and the ecosphere from their developing collapse. That's three interviews. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
The history of human civilization is short, relatively, but scientists are exploring how people adapted or collapsed during earlier changes to their climate. That's information that could help us now as we go into a rapid shift. We're going to go back about 5,000 years towards the start of human organization, and that's when the Indus civilization formed around the Indus River of northwest India and now Pakistan. A new article in the journal Current Anthropology draws on studies by the Banaras Hindu University and the University of Cambridge in the UK. We'll talk with the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie, from Cambridge's Division of Archaeology. Educated at the University of Sydney, Dr. Petrie went on to specialize in the archaeology of India, Pakistan, and Iran. Cameron Petrie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Very nice to be speaking to you.
Where was the Indus civilization? Can you put it on a map for us?
Sure. The Indus civilization is now spread across two different countries. The earliest Indus sites were actually discovered in areas which are now parts of Pakistan. So they stretch across quite large parts of the plains of Pakistan. The modern provinces of Sindh and Punjab. And then after independence and partition in the middle part of the 20th century, people started to discover a lot of archaeological sites that were in the borders of modern India as well. So it stretches across parts of the northwest part of India, modern states of Indian Punjab and Haryana. And there's also Indus populations that are known to live in the states of Gujarat as well, which is sort of more strictly western India, I guess.
And how does it compare in time with the pyramids of Egypt or the early settlements of Mesopotamia?
Well, broadly contemporaneous. So the Indus civilization has a long period of development, and the main thrust of that development seems to take place in the third millennium BC, so from around 5,000 years ago. And then around 2500 BC, the Indus civilization sort of has an urban phase. So we see the development of large urban centers. They're around 80 hectares in size, you know, probably populations more than 50,000 people living together. And that urban period seems to last for around 500 or 600 years. And then, I guess, in terms of comparing to Mesopotamia and Egypt, I mean, that's at about the same time. In Mesopotamia, that's about the same time as the early dynastic period, the end of the sort of first phase of city-states in Mesopotamia. And then when we see people like Sargon of Akkadian becoming, you know, ruling the first sort of large Mesopotamian, I guess, proto-empire. So, yeah, and then in terms of connections to Egypt, I mean, we're talking broadly contemporaneous with the sort of phases of the major phase of pyramid building in Egypt as well. So the Indus is comparable with the ancient complex societies of Mesopotamia and Egypt in terms of period and complexity, but it's different, of course.
And why do Western people know less about the Indus civilization, and do people from India know more about it?
It's a good question, because I think, you know, we know a lot about Egypt and Mesopotamia, and because it's sort of infiltrated into a lot of the sort of religious texts like the Bible and a lot of the other sorts of textual documents that have survived from antiquity. Whereas the Indus civilization didn't sort of filter through into the sort of Western tradition in terms of documentation. So there's no references to the Indus civilization in any of these ancient texts that survive, and there were little bits and pieces, references to regions to the east that appeared in Mesopotamian texts, but they were only really translated in the 19th and 20th centuries. So it was very much a sort of lost civilization, and it was referred to as a lost civilization when it was sort of rediscovered in the early part of the 20th century. And in many ways, it had sort of slipped out of the consciousness even within India and Pakistan. So there was, people recognized that there were these ancient things in the landscape, you know, the giant mounds that existed, and you know, objects were found on the surfaces of these mounds, but it wasn't really clear what they were. And, you know, archaeologists, Indian archaeologists, British archaeologists that were based in India in the 19th century were going out and visiting these archaeological sites and collecting material from them. And some of that material ended up in places like the British Museum, but it wasn't really understood until the early part of the 20th century. And since then, there's been a lot, you know, progressive amounts of archaeological research, and we're gradually sort of filling in the pieces in terms of what we understand.
At the peak, would we recognize these settlements as cities?
It's a good question, and it's a sort of debated question. But purely on the basis of their size, these are sort of, in many ways, massive entities, and you know, they would have had populations of thousands and thousands of people. You know, they typically, the settlements either have large walls around them or they're built up on large platforms, so they would have been very visually striking. And you know, they would have been in the middle of a sort of very, very active landscape where people were interacting with each other. But there's some things that mark them out as being quite different to what we see in Mesopotamia, for example. There's not very many of these Indus cities, especially considering the enormous area that it encompassed. So there's only really a very small number of very, very large centres. Whereas in Mesopotamia, there's lots of centres that exist in a much smaller area. So it's quite clear that there are very different sort of social or urban fabric that exists in these different areas. So I think, yeah, they must have looked like cities in some respects, and they would have certainly been urban if you think of the difference between urban and rural. There's definitely small numbers of urban settlement in the Indus realm, but very much a sort of rural landscape otherwise. So it would have been quite something to encounter this sort of urban center, I think.
With that setting in mind, Cameron, when did a change in climate arrive for the Indus Valley people?
Well, as far as we can ascertain, around about, say, 2100 BC, so a little, you know, 4,200, 4,100 years ago, there's growing evidence that there was a weakening of the monsoon. So one of the things that marks the Indus out as being quite different to most other early complex societies is that it developed in an area which is quite delicate and nuanced in terms of its environment and its climate. So it's right on the edge of where the winter rain system comes, so a winter rain system that affects the areas of the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and it's where the Indus River is sort of the limit of that rainfall system. And then it's also at another edge of the Indian monsoon rainfall system as well. So it both benefits from those two rainfall systems and is quite vulnerable to changes in those rainfall systems because, you know, if you don't get enough rain, it's at the edges that it's can have the most effect. So around 4,200, 4,100 years ago, it looks like the monsoon weakened. And as a result of that, there seems to have been less rain. And one of the questions that we're still puzzling over is precisely how long that period of weak rain extended. And on the basis of the evidence that we've got at the moment, we've looked at a series of lakes, dried up lakes in northwestern India. And in one of those lakes, we had very clear evidence that there was a sharp change. So the lake went from being a relatively shallow lake to being effectively an ephemeral lake that only filled up in the rainy season. And that happened around this point in time. So it's clear that the monsoon was weak. It's very, very likely that that weakness was protracted. And some suggestions have been put forward that maybe this period of weak rain was extended for up to 200 years. And, you know, that's a massive extended drought in anyone's language. And it's inevitable that that would have had massive effects on local environment and various sorts of other things. But at the moment, we're sort of just getting glimpses of how this is impacting upon the local landscape. And we know from other locations in Bangladesh and in Oman that there was a weakened monsoon in those areas as well. So we're gradually sort of putting the pieces together to work out the patterns of these climate changes that have occurred in the past.
Well, I'm about to mispronounce a word because I don't really know what it means, and I'm asking you, what on earth is a speleothem, and how are they used to assess climate?
You didn't get far off the pronunciation, but a speleothem is effectively, it's like a stalagmite that comes out of a cave. And why speleothems are particularly interesting for reconstructing climate is basically they form in relationship to precipitation. So when the rain comes, the water percolates into the ground and it produces deposit formations in caves. And so these stalagmites effectively have the equivalent of tree rings on them that they grow over time. And the reason that that's interesting in terms of climate is because they're actually a very sensitive measure of variation in the amount of rain that comes. So they give you an indication of high rainfall or low rainfall over time. And the other thing that's very good for these sorts of formations is that they can be dated very, very accurately with uranium-thorium dating. And that sort of dating technique is much more accurate than the traditional method that we use in archaeology, which is radiocarbon dating. So radiocarbon dating, you get errors of up to 100 or 200 years, whereas uranium-thorium dating, you get it much, much narrower. And if all the stars are aligned, you can get it down to less than 10 years or down to 3 or 5 years and things like that. So you can actually get very, very sensitive climatic information out of such features in caves.
Now, when the normal crop system failed, did Indus cities break down?
Well, this is one of the questions that we've been really interested in exploring. So I think people have known for a long time that the Indus farmers were quite innovative and clever. And you know, because of these two weather systems, they were quite conscious of growing crops that were suitable for their local environments. So in our area, we were quite conscious about looking at how diverse their farming system was. And some of the things that we discovered was, you know, that it was actually a very, very diverse farming system. And it appears as though they were using more crops than had previously been known. So we discovered that they were using rice in the period before Indus urban cities developed, and then the use of rice continued as well. And they were using millet crops, a range of different millet crops, and both rice and millet can be grown when you get summer rain. And in addition, they're growing wheat and barley and different sorts of lentils and things like that. And all of that can be grown when you get winter rain. So you get with these two different rainfall systems existing, farmers were able to sort of adapt their cropping systems to match the availability of water in different seasons. And I think part of the older sort of idea about the sort of Indus cropping was that people recognized that it was diverse, but there was a general view that a lot of it was focused on the winter crops. So I think some of our research was highlighting that, you know, in actual fact, the diversity is more extensive than was previously thought. And the question then comes, what happens then when the rain becomes weak and people have to sort of make adaptations? And some of the older suggestions was related to the fact that perhaps they made a switch to some of the crops that were more hardy, or they became more diverse over time. But it seems, on the basis of what we've discovered, it was that they were diverse all along. And it seems like that people were always making choices, and so that has all sorts of implications if you think about how a state operates, for example, and whether a state insists that farmers need to grow certain crops or they can grow different crops, and, you know, how people pay taxes and all of these sorts of issues and ideas. So by recognizing that their practices are diverse, it throws up all sorts of interesting questions. And you can ask, you know, how does this society operate and various other things. And then when those sorts of questions are in the mix, then all of a sudden we say, oh, and also what happened if the rain didn't come? So it's very, very interesting, because it means, you know, people are, in some respects, some of these populations and farmers are actually in a situation where they can make choices anyway. So it seems quite likely that they were able to make choices about the crops that they were growing on the basis of the real-time availability of water that was available. So perhaps they were able to make clever choices and be resilient. But one of the things I suspect that becomes difficult when you have less rainfall is to be able to feed large populations. So, you know, my personal view is that perhaps, you know, if the rain becomes weak and you have to engage in, you know, risk mitigation, you have to make decisions about which crops you grow. Maybe you grow crops in smaller fields. You can't feed as many people. And this is where, you know, over time, as far as we can work out, it appears as though the Indus cities gradually become depopulated and most of them become abandoned. And it's very possible that this is a sort of a response to the climate change event. You know, it's more difficult to feed people in large populations. It's easier to feed them in smaller populations. So this sort of fits with a bigger archaeological narrative that we see where, you know, it looks like the cities become less popular and we see many more villages appearing in the landscape.
I think there may be another critical difference. This is just a guess on my part between earlier civilizations and ourselves, and that is that in earlier ages, growing food did not stop at city limits. There were crops and animals right throughout wherever anybody lived, and I think that might have helped slow down the process of emptying the cities or given them some resilience that we don't have.
Yeah, I think it's possible that the rural nature of the Indus landscape definitely made it sort of possible for them to sort of make changes and responses. And I think it's also possible that there was always a very close connection between the populations of the city and the populations of the country. And this has been thought about for a long time, actually. You know, scholars going back 40, 50 years have been proposing this as a possibility. And, I mean, you know, so if you think about how populations work today, you know, people do tend to be city dwellers if they're a city dweller. But I think in the Indus world, it's possible that you might have had extended family groups that were connected to, you know, villages. And even today, people all over India and Pakistan have, even though they may well live in a city, they have a home village, in a sense, where their family comes from. So there may well be social mechanisms that exist that allow people to sort of leave a city and still maintain all sorts of social connections. And so, you know, they can spread out into a landscape. You know, the land is very much today, lots of land is being used very, very intensively. And I think when you move towards mechanization, you reduce the number of people that are actually involved in the process. And so more people are being fed off less actual physical labor in some respects. I think in the past, that wasn't so extreme. So probably when, you know, people move out of a city or they're, you know, inhabiting a countryside more intensively, they're able to engage in smaller scale farming. And perhaps that's sort of quite a successful method to survive in periods of change and stress and other sorts of things.
Do you think there's more knowledge that we can gain from studying the Indus civilization that might help us now that climate change is heating up for us and uncertain effects on our weather?
I think, you know, I'm constantly trying to think of ways in which my research can be relevant other than just thinking of, oh gosh, isn't that interesting? We're learning about the past. And I think it's, you know, in this instance, it's there's a challenge because I think in many ways agricultural production has transformed so profoundly. So if you've got, you know, an example from the past where people have engaged in sort of successful behavior and activities where they're taking lessons from farming, it's a little bit difficult to apply it directly. But I think some of these issues about diversification and I think in many ways maybe the degree to which the ancient population was carefully in tune with their environment and not so keen perhaps to modify that environment but to live within its limits. And I mean, I think that's a lesson that wouldn't surprise a lot of people in some ways where, you know, for example, in modern India now, there's quite an extreme use of groundwater. So there's a lot of pumping to engage in intensive agriculture. And this results in, you know, the India's ability to support an enormous population. But it also creates incredible stresses on the environment. So I think these sorts of issues are going to become very relevant when it comes, you know, if we have increasing variability in rainfall and we have more extended periods of drought, then you know, some of the big, you know, intensive agricultural projects are going to become very vulnerable. And I think populations are going to really have to think more about the intense way that they use water. And so that sort of approach of, you know, I think being a bit realistic about, you know, the degree to which we can actually apply information from 5,000 years ago is a good word of caution. I think it would be ridiculously ambitious to say, oh yeah, you can just apply this to the modern world. But I think it's an interesting lesson in the sense that people being willing to operate within the limits of the capacity of the land and then perhaps adapting their behavior to suit changes in the environment, I think those are helpful lessons, really.
Indeed. Could you tell us what the Land, Water and Settlement Project is?
The Land, Water and Settlement Project was something that was established in 2008, and we were given funding from a variety of different funding bodies in 2007, and we set out to really investigate the area of northwestern India and to try and get some understanding about long-term social change, long-term environmental change in this particular region. And partly because this is an area where we have evidence for the Indus civilization as this sort of first phase of urbanism in the subcontinent. And it's also an area where we have evidence for a second period of urbanism, which happens about 2,500 years ago. We see the beginning of a second urban phase. So we were very much interested in looking at long-term social change, long-term environmental change, and trying to see what the relationships were between humans and their environment. And in some ways, I think one of our original aims was to look at the decline of the Indus civilization and to try and see whether there was environmental role played. You know, was there climate change? If so, how did people respond to it? And as the project developed, we came upon some very clear evidence that climate change occurred, and clear evidence for all sorts of different social dynamics and changes, urbanization, deurbanization, shifts in settlement, different decisions being made by local populations. And it was very interesting from our perspective. It was quite clear that the local populations engage with, you know, broader connective networks. They trade over great distances, but they're also very much focused on what's happening in a local sort of setting. So this is, from our perspective, we were really trying to get an understanding of this particular part of India and how it was intersecting with other areas.
And now the Two Rains Project, who's funding that? What's its aim?
The Two Rains Project was very much a sort of, in some ways, a logical extension and an expansion of what we attempted with the Land Water Settlement Project. So we were funded, the Two Rains Project was funded in 2015 by the European Research Council. And this has allowed us to bring in a number of new doctoral students and postdoctoral researchers, and we can sort of, in some respects, expand the research that we're attempting on the ground and also do it a little bit more intensively. And so we're very much focused on this whole idea, the two rainfall systems and the distinctive nature of the Indus environmental context, but then really trying to focus on this question of, does climate change actually cause collapse? That's actually the sort of, in some ways, a reasonably coarse question. But we're really trying to look at whether or not climate change is a sort of driver for these social changes. Well, you know, is climate change a real forcing mechanism? And, I mean, one of the reasons that we're asking that as a question rather than assuming that it is actually the cause is because we know, for example, that the Indus civilization didn't just sort of vanish once this climate change event happened. People don't just sort of run screaming without trying to change things, trying to adapt, trying to be resilient and trying to overcome things. So we really wanted to look at, you know, what are the mechanisms that we can reconstruct and what can we say about the landscape? What can we say about how people lived in that landscape? How did they farm and how did they make decisions? And, you know, some of that is related to how they kept animals and whether they, you know, provided the animals with water even though there wasn't a lot of water available. You know, if they're trying to grow crops, were their crops under stress or were they not under stress? And these sorts of issues where we're really trying to unpack a question about climate change and collapse and really understand it in a little bit more detail rather than just assuming that those things are definitely connected.
Well worth doing, and you can find out more, listeners, in the paper Adaptation to Variable Environments, Resilience to Climate Change, Investigating Land, Water, and Settlement in the Indus, Northwest India. It was published in the journal Current Anthropology on January 27, 2017. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie. He is a reader in South Asian and Iranian archaeology at the University of Cambridge. And you can find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Cameron, thank you so much for helping us out.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, our special on collapse, how, why, and how to avoid it. Our guide to the collapse of the Mayan civilization is one of the world's experts. Takeshi Inamata is a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. He also has a chair in environment and social justice. Dr. Inamata has published books, popular articles, and many key papers on thousands of years of the Maya people. Takeshi Inamata is the lead author of a new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's the most accurate yet on when and at what pace social and economic upheaval happened in the Mayan culture. That helps explain how this advanced civilization came apart until the cities were abandoned. Dr. Inamata, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Let's locate ourselves. Where is the Maya site of Sabal that you studied intensively?
Yeah, that's in Guatemala, in the lowland part of the country. So the northern part of Guatemala, close to Mexico, it's a tropical lowland where you have rainforest. And the Sabal is located in the area, pretty close to the border with Mexico.
How many people lived in Sabal? And if we could travel back in time, would we recognize this as a city?
Yes. In its heyday, which is what we call classic period from the 2nd to 9th century, it probably had about 5,000 to 10,000 people. So it was something like city. It depends on what you, how you define city. But it had a ruler, it had the temple, and then it had the plazas where people gathered. So it had a lot of these functions of city.
And for this paper, you took a couple of main periods out of that long history of the Maya. When were you studying, really?
It can be divided into two main periods. One is pre-classic period, which is before 2nd AD. And the next one is a classic period, which is from 2nd to 9th century AD. Then, yeah, we studied the end of each of these periods.
Why did you study the end of those periods?
Well, that's always the big question in Maya archaeology. Many centers were abandoned at the end of each of these periods. That has been a major focus of debate and studies.
Well, you know, in our hypermodern civilization, a lot of my listeners worry about collapse, and there are places on Reddit where you can just talk about collapse. They have different reasons why they think it could happen, and one of the big debates is whether civilizations tend to break up quickly or do they fade away slowly. What is your estimate from the times that you studied in this paper?
So we think that the key is chronology and dating. So when you have coarse chronology of your dating is not very precise, the whole process looks very gradual. Most people thought that the classic collapse, for example, happened over a century. But when you see, when you have more refined chronology, then you can see much more detailed social changes that happens within this period of what we call collapse. We have a period of fast decline, political decline, followed by limited recovery. Then we have a major abandonment of many cities. Then some cities comes back and had the recovery, but then many of them also had final abandonment.
Well, as you're aware, a series of papers over the last dozen years suggest a long-lasting drought created tensions that led to regional wars. You've cited a half-dozen climate-leaning studies in your paper references. Do you think climate change was one factor that helped the Mayan civilization collapse?
That's still an open question. So by now, we have enough evidence that indicate that there were some droughts at each of those periods of collapse. But was it the main cause of the collapse? That's still a question. Then we see our work was a sort of step toward getting a better answer to this question. At the beginning, so we have a initial political decline, which seems to be related to social problems. We see the intensification of warfare, and then people started to live in fortified locations. Then we have this major episode of abandonment, which may be related to drought. So picture may be pretty complex, and then we still need more work. But by refining this kind of chronology, we hope that we can get to clearer answers.
Well, we do need to understand how climate change affects civilizations because of our own pressing needs in the fossil fuel age, but I think you might agree we don't want to let that blind us or distort our view when we look into the past to see what happened.
Yeah, that's an important point. But the same problem is happening, well, particularly in this area. And another important factor is the deforestation. And then right now, deforestation is happening in this area of Guatemala and then adjacent areas. Then these kind of problem may have led to social problems. Then in that sense, it's probably important to study what happened in the past in order to think about today's problems too.
And this paper compares two collapses of the Maya. The first was during the time of the Roman Empire, and the second during the Dark Ages in Europe. What did the two Maya collapses have in common?
We looked at the two events, two periods of collapse, at the end of pre-classic period, and then the other one at the end of classic period. But in both cases, we find that there was those smaller episodes or waves of political decline. First, there was some political decline, and then recovery, and then major episode of abandonment, then some recovery, and then final abandonment. So this pattern happened in both cases, at the end of pre-classic period and then at the end of the classic period. So this is probably telling us something very important about the nature of social change and then possibly about the causes of these changes. Although we don't know exactly what they were, but we think that this is giving us important hints.
And yet, your paper finds these two similar collapses produced very different outcomes, and I think there's a critical lesson there. Please talk to us about the two different routes after the collapse.
Yes, that's the interesting part. So during or after the pre-classic collapse, some major centers declined and got abandoned, but some survived, and then those surviving ones led to the emergence of Maya dynasties. So the time of collapse was the time of the establishment of Maya kingship. Then you get into this heyday of Maya civilization, which is the classic period. But at the end of classic period, again, many centers or cities were abandoned, but that really marked the end of certain kind of kingship, what we call divine kingship. Then Maya civilization continued after the classic period and the Maya. There are still lots of Maya people today in Guatemala and Mexico and other countries. And then they did, after the classic period, they did have some kind of kingship, but it was very different, not so heavily based on religious leadership. And then there seems to have been some important political change happened with the classic collapse.
I find this fascinating because if the international order does break down or the grid fails for some reason, some of us hope for new local governments and greater freedom, and others fear the multi-billionaire families will continue as dynasties ruling during another dark age. You've taken a special interest in the timing and development of great dynasties in Mayan culture. Why is that important?
Basically, we are looking at the change in political system and then kingship. Or dynasty is really the core of this political system in Maya society. So in a broader sense, we are interested in how political organization change And in that sense, that relates to political change that happened in today's world, too.
And the Maya had many gifts. They had a written language, mathematics, astronomy, and amazing architecture. But they also had a reputation for brutality. What were those practices, and was that built into the religion of power?
I don't want to emphasize too much this aspect of brutality. Well, every civilization had that aspect. Almost every society was involved in warfare, some form of violence. And the Maya had a unique form of violence, including human sacrifice. But it doesn't mean that the Maya people are more brutal or violent than other people. I see it as really the aspect of every civilization, including our own society.
Well, certainly the Romans were a brutal people, and yes, we've had our share of wars and bombings. So why do you think that North Americans know more about Greece and Rome than the great Maya civilization that flourished right on this continent?
Yes, that's a good question. Partly because we didn't know too much about the Maya civilization. We couldn't read glyphs, and so we didn't know much about the history of Maya people. But now we have much more archaeological studies, and then we can read text and glyph, Maya glyphs. Then we know much more about the Maya civilization these days. Also, it may relate to today's status of Maya people. Maya people has been economically disadvantageous positions. I think it is important to learn their culture and their historical heritage, and that should probably relate to the respect for those people who live in this area today.
Yes, the Chiapas Rebellion in southern Mexico traced some of its roots to the Maya people.
Yes, that's another area that the Maya people still live, and there are lots of political issues in those areas. Guatemala had civil war, which was very much tied to this division between the indigenous people and the government.
Can you recommend books, even fiction books, that give us a realistic picture of Maya history and what it would be like to live in those times?
I did one book with my colleague Steve Houston. It's called The Classic Maya, which gives pretty much an overview of this civilization.
And when you do your work in the field, do you sometimes think about lessons for modern times?
As we talked about, Maya people may have faced the similar problems and challenges that we face today, including the climate change, and also the problem of deforestation, and then also the problem of political violence and warfare. So I'm not saying that we can get the direct lesson for today's world, but it is important to know about the past in order to think about today and the future.
Is there still a lot of work to be done to solve this mystery of what happened to the Maya?
Certainly. I think we are making a good progress, but still we need lots of work. And also one concern is that lots of archaeological sites are being destroyed, along with deforestation and economic development. Then in that case, all the information is gone, it's lost forever. So that's one concern.
We've been discussing the new paper titled High Precision Radiocarbon Dating of Political Collapse and Dynastic Origins at the Maya Site of Ceibal, Guatemala. It was published December 19, 2016 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Our guest is the lead author, Professor Takeshi Inamata, from the Department of Anthropology at the University of Arizona. You can find links to Professor Inamata and the science we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Takeshi, thank you so much for helping us understand.
Thank you very much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Scientists and pundits suggest we need World War II-style mobilization to fight climate change. But what will it really take if we had the will to save ourselves from devastating climate change? What could we do? That's the task of a new book from Dr. Lawrence L. Delina. He's a postdoctoral associate at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. That's at Boston University. Lawrence is also the Rachel Carson Fellow at LMU University in Germany. From Munich, Lawrence Delina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Pleasure to be in your radio show.
Well, yes, we're going to talk about your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. And there is a question mark at the end of that title. Why?
That's actually intentional. I'm offering the book as a critical take of the lessons and strategies for wartime mobilization as a possible policy model for rapid climate mitigation. That is, whether those moments in history can actually provide us lenses by which we, as contemporary human beings, can address the biggest challenge of our time, climate change. And the question mark at the end of the book subtitle signals that that particular critical take.
And the book comes with a foreword by one of my climate heroes, Dr. Hans Schellenhuber. And early on, he dared to ask the question, what if we go beyond 4 degrees C of heating? There were two conferences on that. Lawrence, do you know John Schellenhuber, and what does his foreword offer us?
I haven't personally met John yet, but I hope to make his acquaintance while I'm in Germany. John wrote the foreword to my book a few days after the Paris Agreement came out in December of 2015, and about 6 months after the release of Pope Francis' encyclical Laudato Si, which John presented in Vatican that June that year. In his foreword to my book, Jen talks about the main actors in what he calls a 3D drama of saving the world. First of these is disasters that teach people around the world that climate change is no joke and no fun. Second is discovery or innovation enabling leap forwards in technologies. And third is dignity or the morality of preserving the livelihoods of our brothers and sisters, which is basically the thrust of the Pope's encyclical.
That sounds pretty interesting to me, but strange as it sounds, I'm going to skip your first chapter on the awful things that will happen if we continue with fossil power. We'll probably get to that at some point. But you do tackle next the gritty question of whether we can find enough renewable energy in time to save us from catastrophic climate change. In general, what did you find?
My major finding is that the technology for transitioning towards a global, low-carbon, sustainable economy is ready. This includes technically piloted and demonstrated wind, water, and sunlight systems, which are also fast becoming economically affordable. Now, there is a preponderance of studies, models, and scenarios that points to this possibility. And I've mentioned the global nature of a 100% renewable energy future, but a number of studies have also emerged as of late showing the specifics and how every country on Earth can actually progress in their transitions using only the renewable energy technologies that we already have.
And your scenario for doing what we need is called the Rapid Mitigation Agreement. Please tell us about that.
The agreement sets the stage for achieving deep national cuts in emissions with a window for auditing national achievements. The agreement makes very clear that we want to achieve a global target of close to zero emissions from the energy sector within 30 years, but not later than 2035 for richer emission states, which are historically at their highest. For developing states, the target will be within 40 years, but not later than 2050. So this particularly ensures that by mid-century, 2050, global emissions have peaked and will be declining really, really steeply. The agreement is different from what we currently have, Paris Agreement, in that the proposed agreement would address free riding by bluntly assigning targets and timetables in a top-down scheme. Now, that approach may appear pathetic to many, especially in the context of the bottom-up approach that generally led to the Paris Agreement. But the proposal is to be appreciated in the context of a wartime approach, where during the war, belligerent nations have actually spent up to 70% of their GDP on military.
What are we going to do about rogue countries? Well, we could almost count the United States in that because they signed up for the Paris Climate Agreement and now threaten to withdraw from it, and they're pushing more fossil fuel production. How will we handle that after the Rapid Mitigation Agreement is signed?
So what makes the proposed rapid mitigation agreement different in that? Here, I called for an audit mechanism that would reduce the possibility that some nations might break off it and to lay sanctions for countries that fail to meet the targets. To illustrate this, I called on that historical moment in Casablanca in January 1943, during which the Second World War actually peaked.
And what was that agreement? I'm sorry, I don't know my history on that.
So the 1943 Casablanca Agreement between Allied nations included a text by which Allied leaders who that time, January 1943, met at Casablanca in then France, Morocco, and they decided that the only way to ensure post-war peace was to actually adopt a policy of non-conditional surrender. So this policy was made to avoid a situation that followed the First World War, where large segments of German society supported the position that Germany was not defeated militarily, hence the German rearmament and consequently the violation of the Treaty of Versailles. What we don't want to occur is another Treaty of Versailles-like infraction happening in the period of rapid mitigation, during which the rapid climate mitigation is in effect. And using the Casablanca Agreement as a model, the rapid mitigation agreement has to do at least four key things. The first is to establish mandatory emission cuts to ensure a 100% renewable energy regime before 2050. Second is to establish an assessed contributions approach to a multilateral fund to support the transition of developing countries. Third is to establish a global monitoring mechanism that would periodically review mitigation targets. And fourth, to establish penalties for non-adherence or secession from the agreement through trade sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, reduced foreign aid, and censure at international forums.
Now, Lord Stelina, let's talk about motivation. Science is pretty clear there will be widespread and devastating climate events if we continue to load up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. But beyond that sort of gradual building storm, if you will, there are also some black swan events. What are some of those less likely but powerful climate signals we might see?
You are very right. The science is very clear on the devastating and large-scale impacts of global climate change. Now, black swans actually refer to those tail events in your bell-shaped probability distribution curves, if you remember your Statistics 101. In normal bell curves, these tail events signify unlikely outcomes. Outcomes from climate impacts, however, have high likelihood, meaning you can have fatter tails. This means that we can have, in an unchecked climate change, more of gray swans or even the more familiar white swans. Now, these events are highly catastrophic. And according to one analysis, they include the following. The melting of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, a dieback of the Amazon rainforest, and more persistent El Nino regimes. Now, how likely these events are to happen? The scientists estimate that at least one of these tipping points or tipping events will be triggered in a temperature increase of up to 2 degrees Celsius. It's very close. And more than one of these events can actually occur in a temperature increase of 4 degrees Celsius. Now, a simpler reading would say that these events are not totally remote.
I know that Russia experienced severe fires and heat waves in 2010, and they still are fossil pushers, really. And we had tens of thousands die in the French heat wave, and much of Pakistan was flooded. Hurricane Sandy cost billions. And yet we're still not motivated, apparently. What will it take and what could happen that would send the world a big enough signal?
In the book, I discussed that climate-related events, however catastrophic they are, those black swans, which are actually white swans, are not guarantees that governments will act aggressively against climate change. So that is one of the many aspects where the analogy between wartime mobilization and climate mobilization diverges and becomes a little bit problematic. Whereas wartime mobilization was triggered by aggressive threats on territories such as the attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila, which was then under American control, which eventually triggered the United States mobilization for war, the stimuli for a rapid mitigation program are very hard to predict. I would like to believe that signals would come from a variety of sources. This would include extreme climate events for sure, but you can also discount the role of a stronger climate action movement.
Well, I know that the World War II economy depended on an enormous expansion of public debt, and even before the climate challenge, we already have stupendous debt at almost every level of government and even personally. Is there really any room for more debt without destroying completely the value of money? Is debt part of the program that you envision?
You are right. The Second World War ushered in an unprecedented volume of public debt. Contrary to concerns over stupendous public debt, however, it is the growth and acceleration of private debt that we should be worried about. This is because private debt drives asset price inflation or bubbles, which always burst, and in effect, they cause economic destruction and financial disruption. Private debt insurance, not public borrowing per se, should be controlled. This doesn't mean, however, that we continue on borrowing till kingdom come. Societies must be emancipated from the constraints of debt, including those made by the governments. As I have described in the book, public borrowing to finance the sustainable energy transition has to come as a complement to taxation. Taxing carbon polluters remain a key policy I am advancing in the book, and I have also discussed several proposals for new forms of taxation, including a progressive tax that can be levied on consumption. But tax and borrowing are but two ways to fund the transition or the rapid mitigation project. There's still the need to source money beyond these traditional mechanisms. I have listed a number of approaches, ways, and means in the book, but that include taking out fossil fuel subsidies and revisiting national budget items apportioned for defense and wars and realigning them to the purposes of the transition.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and scholar, Dr. Lawrence Delina. We're talking about using World War II mobilization as a model to combat climate change. One of the hallmarks of World War II, Lawrence, I think, in the United States and Canada, even more in Britain and Germany, was rationing of consumer goods. Came right down to things like sugar and butter, which were needed to feed the troops. I still think we need to ration consumer goods. Everything we buy contains embedded carbon to produce and transport it and all that. And we need to buy a heck of a lot less, I think, to get emissions down. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Rationing was a hallmark of wartime mobilization, as it is a way to solicit everyone's contribution to the war effort. I haven't discussed rationing of consumer books in the book, as my focus was on the industrial mobilization part. But rationing is key in climate mitigation, especially in envisaging strategies that revisit the way we consume things, which has obvious effects on our emission profiles. Curtailing excessive consumption is essential if we are to effectively address the climate challenge. And you're right, carbon is embedded in all things we do, all things we make, and things we eat. The solutions to anthropogenic global climate change comprise urgent, traumatic, large-scale, and transformative changes in areas beyond how we obtain and consume energy. And a comprehensive approach to effective mitigation ideally involves strategies to decelerate total global economic activity and consumption. In that regard, there is much to learn from wartime rationing.
Your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, doesn't avoid the hardest questions, and a big one is the whole problem of government control and trust in government. And as we've just seen in the American elections, trust in government seems to be at an all-time low, just when we need it most to save the climate. How can we overcome that?
The hardest aspect of climate mobilization is non-technical. It's the social and the political. And as I've mentioned, the technology is ready, waiting to be deployed in the large scale. And it takes staged, structured, planned, and coordinated response to do just that. It is in that area of coordination and marshalling the necessary resources that governments have historically been effective. These lapses in the book and use them regardless to provide us lessons with how governments can possibly mobilize their agencies effectively in the context of rapid climate mitigation. During the war, we saw how the likes of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, providing the much-needed political will and leadership to prosecute wartime efforts and to mobilize industries for wartime. How we wish we could have the same traits from our leaders today. But things are very different nowadays. Trust in government, as you have mentioned, is indeed at an all-time low. We saw that in the American elections of November 2016. We constantly saw it finding almost all over the world. Citizens are losing trust in their governments, more so in their leaders. I don't really have a prescription on how to overcome that challenge in governance. But I take my optimism from a number of initiatives from the local, from the grassroots. The rapid mitigation project, regardless of whether it is a top-down approach, will still need strong citizen engagement. The histories of many successful and violent movements provide us mirrors on how this could be done. That actually is the second strand of my research and one which I am currently developing as a new project here at the Rachel Carson Center. This is a bit about this this follow-up project. I try to look at strategies on strengthening the climate action movement from lessons of many histories, including the people power revolution in my country, the Philippines, the struggle for independence in India, and the modern American civil rights movements, among others. What I'm trying to say here is that these moments of history can actually provide us new strategies for driving rapid climate mitigation. And that can be through climate activism, traditionally construed as people, for example, shouting on the streets and doing civil disobedience. On the other hand, it can also be through prefigurative means, such as people organizing themselves into cooperatives to build solar or wind farms.
I contacted you precisely because so many people have put forward the wartime model as a way to fight climate change, and you ended the title with a question mark. What do you think in the end? Were you able to develop a model that could work in the real world?
What I learned is that, yes, there are opportunities for learning from the industrial mobilization for Second World War and possibly apply those lessons in the context of rapid mobilization for climate change. I have shown that strategies can be developed in terms of mobilizing finance, labor, and administrative resources to quickly deploy renewable energy technologies. This is the model that I think can work in the real world. However, there are caveats to the analogy. We have to be actually cautious if we are to adopt similar wartime strategies in addressing climate change. We don't want our government to become a coercive one, although we are seeing a lot of governments today turning into one. In that regard, I propose in the book, and this is part of the model, the creation of an equally strong institution to ensure that what governments do are in line with the objectives of rapid mitigation, and that is to quickly replace fossil fuel systems with renewable ones using energy generated from wind, water, and solar, and nothing else. Now, there is no guarantee that governments would actually do that. I raise in the book the likelihood that governments would actually elect to do large-scale risk engineering, to possibly build walls to keep away climate refugees and others. Adaptation, of course, is important, but that misses the opportunity to address the challenge at its root causes, and that is to rapidly zero out emissions.
As we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yes, the wartime model for rapid climate mitigation is strong in one sense. At the same time, it has limitations. I accept that there will be critiques and questions about the technical, social, or political assumptions I made in the book. Many of the strategies for rapid climate mitigation I discussed there are unattractive, controversial alternatives, especially if viewed in a predominantly market-oriented frame of mind. Many of the strategies I presented in the book are highly idealized and utopian, even for progressives. And for liberals, they can be considered highly intrusive. But I would like to invite everyone listening to us to consider a very short thought experiment. When climate impacts hit us in a scale, scope, and intensity beyond our expectations, beyond our current imaginations, during such events, what do you think will government do? Most likely than not, they will expand their power and most possibly intrude into our private lives. Now, we have a choice. Shall we wait for that situation to pan out and have confused governments responding to forced migrations, conflicts, famines, or we use the contingency strategies this book is advancing, proceed and activate an organized government to mobilize resources for rapid mitigation within a bounded portfolio of plans and activities with oversight built into it? Now, I'm not really a fan of both, but the latter strikes me as the lesser of the two evils.
I completely understand. We've been speaking with Lawrence Delina, educated in the Philippines, New Zealand, and Australia. Lawrence has been a visiting scholar at the Harvard Kennedy School and an advisor for the United Nations. He studies the longer-range future at Boston University. He's currently at LMU Munich. Lawrence Delina's new book, published by Routledge, is Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. I'll put links for you to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Plus, you can download any of our past programs for free. Pass it on. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.